pursued justice in the courts of Oklahoma, but also began to communicate with legislators and the political side of the death penalty. And these are all, 60 of them, GOP pro-death penalty legislators that Don works with, educates. Then they start doing their own investigation about Richard's case, visit him, see him, meet him personally, and become very, very committed. And then in that number become the attorney general calls them. I've been with Richard two times where he came really within minutes the last time of execution. The man has gone through torture, but it's refreshing to have, for the first time, an attorney general confess error in a case, because normally prosecution and the attorney general, everybody in the state just holds fast, refuses to acknowledge error, and lets people be executed.
So, Sister Helen Prejean, what happens next? This is a temporary stay of execution? What happens?
Yeah, well, probably it'll be a 30-day at first, but I'm really hopeful that when you have eight justices taking a writ of certiorari on a case, and you have prosecution refusing now to prosecute, then it means that I believe what will happen is they'll remand the case. They'll overturn what the Court of Appeals did in Oklahoma and remand the case to the trial court again for another trial. And they're not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole because they have exposed through investigation the corruption that's been present in the prosecution of destroying evidence, of allowing lies by the chief witness, supposedly that Richard Glossop masterminded it. They allowed those lies in court, hid from the jury that Justin Snead, the one who claimed with, I mean, the videos show how the detectives just pumped that information to him that Richard Glossop was the mastermind. Justin Snead had admitted from the beginning he murdered this guy. So all that stuff would come out in a new trial. I believe Richard's going to walk out a free man.
And of course,
but just, you know what, Amy?
Go ahead.
Amy, just all the other guys on death row that are lined up for execution, they don't have teams like this working for them. What is going to happen to them? So my work is to go to the American public. We have to bring people close to the suffering, the needless suffering, that we can keep our society safe without killing human beings. So eight of them came in for a visit while I was visiting with Richard, and they don't have those teams helping them. So they go into Richard saying, can you get us lawyers to help us? And I just feel for them. We got to change the whole thing in the United States to get the death penalty off the table. We can't handle it.
As of January 12th, 2023, Oklahoma had 39 prisoners on death row, 11 scheduled to die this year. Sister Helen Prejean, you're having a justice rally, I think, is scheduled for May 9th. What is being called for there? We just have 20 seconds. Then we're going to do a post show to talk about your history with Richard Glossop.
Yeah. So the rally, which we encourage people to come to, is going to celebrate what happened with Richard, because it's a lot of work and courageous legislators standing up for him. But to look toward the reforms that this bipartisan committee has recommended for the legislature about the death penalty in Oklahoma. 40 reforms. They've done none of them. So we got to look toward reforming the whole system. And that's what the rally is going to focus on.
Well, Sister Helen
Prejean,
as well
as celebration.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'll do part two. Put it at democracynow.org. Sister Helen Prejean, anti-death penalty activist, author of Dead Man Walking. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Around the world, April 24th marks the observance of the Armenian Genocide. On that day in 1915, the Interior Minister of the Ottoman Empire ordered the arrest and hangings of Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople. It was the beginning of a systematic and well-documented plan to eliminate the Armenians, who were Christian and who had been under Ottoman rule and treated as second-class citizens since the 15th century. The unspeakable and gruesome nature of the killings, beheadings of groups of babies, dismemberments, mass burnings, mass drownings, use of toxic gas, lethal injections of morphine, or injections with the blood of typhoid fever patients, render oral histories especially difficult for survivors of the victims. Why did this happen? Despite being deemed inferior to Turkish Muslims, the Armenian community had attained a prestigious position in the Ottoman Empire, and the central authorities there grew apprehensive of their power and their longing for a homeland. The concerted plan of deportation and extermination was effected in large part because World War I demanded the involvement and concern of potential allied countries. As the writer Grigoris Balakian wrote, the war provided the Turkish government, quote, their sole opportunity, one unprecedented, to exploit the chaos of war in order to carry out their extermination plan. As they escaped to several countries, including the United States, a number of Armenians came to New Britain, Connecticut in 1892 to work in the factories of what was then known as the hardware capital of the world. By 1940, nearly 3,000 Armenians lived there in a tight-knit community. As you will hear from the stories of first-generation Armenian survivors who continue to live in New Britain, a shared history, a shared identity, emerges. Some learned about the massacres directly from their parents or family members, while others were not told at all. Often, surviving women were ashamed to talk about what they had experienced because so many of them had been raped or forced into harems. For others, conjuring visual images of the atrocities was too painful to bear. When parents did speak about the crimes they experienced or witnessed, they often spoke in Turkish or Assyrian instead of English or Armenian, so that their children couldn't understand. Most children of survivors say that the topic was a secret, even forbidden. Meeting together to share memories and conversation are Jenny Garabedian, Arthur Shevardian, Ruth Swisher, Harry Mazadorian, and Roxy Maljanian.
Years has gone by, and they still have not acknowledged that this happened, and it was a genocide.
As a nation, how can they deny this? I mean, how can it be denied? It's a half of a population was removed.
I don't like Turks per se because of what they did to our people, but I do enjoy the culture.
Why would I grow up hating the Turks if she didn't tell us stories? Well, then we must have been told something that we hated the Turks.
Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey.
Yeah, I think they were threatened by the culture. And the genocide started in 1915, April 24, in Istanbul, where they took all the intelligentsia of the country and took them outside of the city and hanged them.
The overlay was, of course, religious, with Muslims, and they're the first country to acknowledge Christianity as a national religion. So, you know, there's a lot of history here with all of that.
The other thing that the Turks used to say, where is your Jesus now? Where is he? Why isn't he saving you? Well, they would say this on the death marches.
My brother Ernest was killed in an automobile accident. And his uncle came over to my house and said, hey, Ostian, where is your God now? And she cupped her ears And she said, Chilasim, Chilasim, I don't want to hear that. God gave him to me and God took him away. How much more Christian could you be?
As you will hear from the stories of first-generation Armenian survivors who continue to live in New Britain, Connecticut, a shared history, a shared identity emerges. Some learned about the massacres directly from their parents or family members, while others were not told at all. Often, surviving women were ashamed to talk about what they had experienced, because so many of them had been raped or forced into harems. For others, conjuring up visual images of the atrocities was too painful to bear. When parents did speak about the crimes they experienced or witnessed, they frequently spoke in Turkish or Assyrian instead of English or Armenian, so that their children couldn't understand. Most children of survivors say that the subject was a secret, even forbidden.
My mother did not keep secrets from us. She spoke about the Turks. She hated the Turks. She made us hate the Turks. I remember as a teenager, I wanted to send away for Turhan Bey's picture in Hollywood, and he was a very handsome Turkish actor. We weren't allowed anyway. But the ones who did keep it secret were the ones who were ashamed of what happened. And I know for a fact, many of the older women, older than my mother, had gotten raped. Those are the ones, in my opinion, in this area, were the ones who kept it secret.
I grew up hearing, like the others, my mother didn't talk about it to me, ever. But I was a little girl, and my mother was quite a bit older than I was. She was older when I was born. And so her friends would come over, and they would sit and talk to each other. The next thing you know, they'd all start crying. And I would cry, too. And my mother would turn to me and say, why are you crying? And I'd say, because you're crying, and not knowing why I was crying.
And just recently we found out that this one got raped, that one got raped, and this is why they couldn't talk about it. Now, I don't know about the men, why the men kept it secret, but as far as the women, yes, you're right, the men were too young, but many of the women did get raped, and those are the ones, in my opinion, that really kept it a secret. And my mother told me many stories, so she wasn't ashamed. She didn't have that feeling of being ashamed.
In our house, it was a secret. And then you hear someone would be talking about something, and then as you approach, they say, Biji Oğlan, which means little boy, that's me. And everything would switch into Turkish, and blah, 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 and everybody. And then, you know, some Armenians would come visit from Whitensville, and they'd sit in the living room. They're all talking Turkish. It was a forbidden thing to discuss.
I had heard these stories. As I listened, I really heard these stories. And then the old country. They always talked about the old country. And I had no idea where it was. When I was a little girl, I thought the old country was like Talland, Connecticut. And I just had no idea. But I always wanted to go there. And then I felt terrible because I never had a grandmother or a grandfather or an aunt, a real aunt or an uncle.
As children growing up, you know, friends would come to the house. Now, they would always speak Armenian. But whenever they had an off-color story to tell, and you could always tell it was an off-color story because the way they broke into laughter, it was always told in Turkish or Assyrian. And then they'd revert back to English. So the stories were really not designed for children to hear. It was for them. But you could always tell by their laughter that something was going on, you know, that they didn't want us to know about. And in point of fact, that's what they always did. If there was something going on at the dinner table and they didn't want us to know what was going on, they'd speak Assyrian or Turkish to one another. So that whole business of speaking Turkish and the residual effects of the genocide were interesting, kind of almost juxtaposed one against the other.
Genocide has both physical and non-physical aspects, destroying the national culture of the oppressed group and imposing that of the oppressor. That was the theory of legal scholar Raphael Lemkin, who coined the word genocide in 1943 with the Turkish extermination of the Armenians in mind. While genocide is defined as the organized destruction, in whole or in part, of a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group, Lemkin wrote that a group need not be only physically exterminated to suffer genocide. Erasing a people's cultural identity through destruction of their language, religion, social, and political institutions, that too is genocide. The Armenian genocide, the very first of the 20th century, may be viewed in four distinct segments. The first segment began with the deportation and killing of the 250 intellectuals. Before that, in 1895, Ottoman suspicion of the Armenian population had led to the massacre of 300,000 Armenians by a special order of the government. In 1909, 30,000 more were slaughtered. The second segment involved the conscription of approximately 60,000 Armenian men into the General Turkish Army. They were later disarmed and killed by their Turkish counterparts. The third segment comprised of massacres, deportations, and death marches of women, children, and the elderly into the Syrian deserts. Hundreds of thousands were killed by Turkish soldiers, gendarme, and Kurdish mobs. Others perished from famine, epidemic diseases, and exposure to the elements. Thousands of women and children were raped. Tens of thousands were forcibly converted to Islam. The final segment of the genocide is still ongoing and consists of the denial by the Turkish and United States governments that a genocide even occurred. Despite the body of documentation that exists, Turkey has launched a well-orchestrated and financed campaign of denial through inaccurate scholarship, propaganda, and extensive lobbying. Turkey even has a law which forbids mention of the word genocide.
Article 301 in Turkey essentially makes genocide an illegal word to use, a term. It's a denial. If you don't have the word, it doesn't exist. Genocide didn't exist. And so what you're doing is, in essence, is saying, if we don't recognize the word, if we don't use the word, then all mention, all concept of a genocide disappears. So what can you call it? Massacres? The first Holocaust? I mean, there are a lot of ways you can define it. They've chosen because it's genocide, and it truly was genocide. The issues are deep-seated. The conflicts were deep-seated. It's not only religious. It was control. It was economic. It was financial. Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey. I did some research, historical research as well. A lot of what we have is factual information because I have the original documentation. Some of it is put together from hearsay and then trying to create a story. And in those pieces that we don't know that I've created, I hope 2 + 2 becomes 4 and not 5. But it's close. It's close to the story. And the story begins, my father was born in 1903. He always said he was born in 1905, but when we look through the original documentation, it turns out he was baptized in 1903, so therefore he couldn't have been born in 1905. Likely it had to do with presenting himself as a younger person to be able to latch on to another member of the family to come to the United States as part of the visa process.
As a second-generation Armenian, I too have pieced together the fragments of stories from my family. My grandfather was a medical student at a college in Carpert. He said he had to beg his older sister for the tuition, and when he walked down the street, people would point to him with awe as the person who was going to college. When the genocide started, he enlisted or was drafted into the army. He narrowly and with difficulty escaped and came to the United States. I don't know how, but he was proud of the fact that he didn't have to disguise himself as a woman, as other men did, in order to beg or borrow his way out of the country. Then, in 1918, when Armenia was granted independence, he went back. He said the persecutions not only still existed, but that they were worse than before, so the process of escaping was even more difficult the second time. Coming to this country with no language or professional skills, he got a job in the foundry. In a short time, a flying piece of hot metal burned out one eye. The genocide ruined his life in Armenia and also in the United States. He had sent to the orphanage in Greece for a wife. The Armenian Relief Society paid for sending my grandmother to the United States. But when she got to Ellis Island, they wouldn't let her off the ship because of a gray halo around the iris of one eye. Again, the Relief Society paid to send her to Cuba because entry from there was less stringent. They found her a family to stay with, 9 people in a one-room house with a dirt floor. They took her daily to a clinic for a nurse to put eye drops in her eye. After 6 months, the nurse told the doctor that there was no change, so she must not have had an active, dangerous condition. The doctor agreed. Now it was better for her to enter through Mexico. Her daughter, my aunt, helped tell this story and says how impressed she always was with the kindness of strangers throughout the process. Historic Armenia was located along the Mediterranean Sea, in what exists today as Turkey. It's also, according to the Book of Genesis, where Noah's Ark came to rest, the first nation to adopt Christianity in AD 301. Armenians lived for centuries in their own kingdoms until the Ottoman invasions in the 1200s, when they became second-class citizens. After World War I, the independent Republic of Armenia existed for just 2 years, from 1918 to 1920, in a fragment of what had once been their homeland. While Armenians had been attacked often prior to the massacre of 1895, the later 1915 genocide had the specific goal of eradicating all traces of the ancient nation. With the outbreak of World War I, the Young Turk government wanted to save what remained of the weakened Ottoman Empire. It adopted a policy of pan-Turkism, the establishment of a vast Turkish empire comprised of all Turkish-speaking peoples of the Caucasus and Central Asia extending to China. The goal included the Turkification of all ethnic minorities of the empire. The Armenian population became the main obstacle toward realization of this policy. Although the decision to deport all Armenians from eastern Turkey had been adopted in late 1911, the Young Turks intentionally used World War I as a pretext for its implementation. Of the 3 million Armenians living in Turkey at that time, more than 1.5 million endured unimaginable atrocities, were slaughtered, raped, or forced into Muslim harems. Churches, which formed the religious and cultural backbone of their lives, were destroyed, while homes were burned, property confiscated, and families killed and separated forever. Lucy and Roxy, Araxi, Maljanian, and Mary Abrahamian are sisters. Together they recount their mother's story.
My name is Roxy Yesyan Maljanian. My mother came from the village of Ichme in Harput, Armenia, Turkey now, and I'm one of 3 sisters that are here present representing our family. And the family name was Pilibozhin. Kuyumjan was the deep name. And our mother was born in 1908. And she came here to America after the genocide. And as a little girl, she remembers quite a few things about 1915. And when my mother was in her late 60s, early 70s, she started writing her history in Armenian. And she wrote it in very colloquial Armenian. She was an Armenian school teacher here in New Britain, taught students after she got married and came here. And in her story, since it was in Armenian, my sisters and I translated it after her death. She wrote it in the last years of her life. And she remembered many things of her childhood. And we divided the story into 3 sections. And each sister took a third of it to translate it the best we can. We all read Armenian. Like I said, she did it simply so we can understand it. We knew some of the stories. She talked about them, her childhood in the orphanage. And she'd tell us the nice things, really, about the orphanage. As children, she was 7 years old until she was 18. She was in the orphanage. She remembers the groups of children who were all just like her. They had lots of fun because they were children, and they played games and sports, and they learned crafts in the orphanage. The German Protestant orphanage taught them crafts, handiwork. So they learned many things, reading and writing. So they were happy as much as possible because everybody was in the same situation. And she remained there until 18. And at 18, there were newspapers here in America looking for orphans in different orphanages. And if your name appeared on a list, the orphan director would send a letter to the person in America that we have this child in this orphanage. And they would write to the orphan, and the orphan would identify herself or himself. And in that way, they were able to get to America through a relative that was here. That's one way that people got home. But at 18, you had to leave the orphanage. When she was 7, 1908 to 1915, she was 7 years old. Before she got to the orphanage, she remembers as a little girl, the Turkish people in the villages were all their neighbors, and they got along very good with their neighbors, and they had fun with them because they were all in the same community. Even though the majority in this village was Armenian, they had Turkish people living there too. The trouble started, the rumors start coming into the villages that things were happening, and their children. She was warned that if something happened, you know, you go with your aunts and uncles. Her mother had died when she was a child, and she was living with aunts in the village. And her father was already in America, so they lived with the aunts. The first one of the incidents she writes and talked about was she remembered the gathering of the men in the village. And the village of Ichimad, the houses were low roof, and you can go on your roof and look at what's happening. And the church was right below the street that they lived on. And my sisters and I both, all three of us, have visited Ichimad, and we took two trips to Ichimad so we can kind of visualize what happened. The church was on the street below, and they remember the men being gathered and taken into that church and hollering, and they heard the screams. And the next thing, the church was being burned, and they remember the church being burned and screaming and the hollering of all the people dying in this building. And then she recalled going from house to house. They were starting to hide from things, and you can run on the rooftops in Ichmeh. They were flat roofs close to each other, and you could jump, and you're 7, 8 years old. You jump from building to building. And they were able to jump to the next building and hide in the neighbor's house. So now they knew there was trouble. So you could go down to the next house and the next house and hide somehow. She remembered that. And then when the time came and they were coming into the village and they'd see more, maybe my sister Lucy can relate that part of the village. Do you remember them, the hiding, what the uncle told them to do?
When they came into the homes, they all had to gather whatever belongings they had to start the march. They told my mother, we're going to hide our gold. It's going to be in this chest and come in the back, and we're going to hide it in the ground. But you never, ever tell anybody where it is. So all their gold coins and jewelry, they hid in the backyard, courtyard, wherever it was. And then they gathered them up and they started this horrific march.
The Armenian identity is now a collective one, pieced together from historical documents and personal stories handed down from survivors to their children. The media did cover the events as they happened, and the U.S. ambassador to Turkey, Henry Morgenthau, told the Secretary of State in July 1915 that, quote, a campaign of race extermination is in progress, under a pretext of reprisal against rebellion. On May 6, 1915, the New York Times reported that, quote, the Young Turks have adopted the policy of Sultan Abdulhamid, namely, the annihilation of the Armenians. Recording oral histories, however, was much more difficult. For the most part, it was simply too painful for survivors to talk about what they had been through and witnessed. First-hand accounts do exist because some wrote letters or kept journals that have been translated into English. One comprehensive eyewitness account and political analysis, Armenian Golgotha by Grigoris Balakian, was recently translated by Peter Balakian with Aris Savag. Other survivors shared narratives with their siblings who later told their children what happened. It is not surprising that the legacy of pain still endures 100 years later, as first-generation survivors frequently are moved to tears when they recount the details that have been passed down. In struggling to survive amidst innumerable challenges, many Armenians relied on the kindness of strangers. Getting married provided one way for women to escape safely, with Turks offering to save women if they would marry their sons or other male relatives. Some Turkish families harbored Armenians in order to save them. And refugees' resourcefulness knew no limit, with many heading to neighboring Arab countries, where they used discarded metal and wood to fashion makeshift shelters.
My mother survived two genocides. There was a genocide in 1895. My mother was born in 1886, and she was a 9-year-old girl. And she used to tell the story of her mother taking her to the well and trying to drown her.
Jenny Garabedian's Armenian mother was an orphan and is among many who made their way to the United States.
At that time, because it was just so terrible, at that time, the village priest came along and tried to stop them. And they did obviously stop them. But then my grandparents were taken in the second wave in 1915, aunts, uncles, everything. My mother told me quite a few stories. My uncle, her brother, was married to a woman. The way the genocide started in certain regions of Turkey, and then they moved them south, and then they came to the village of Harpert, and that was one of the stopping places of these marches. She went out to the village, to the barn one night, and there was this woman with no clothes with a little baby in her arms. And the woman said to her, try to help me, whatever you can do, you know, I would appreciate. And my mother said her brother's wife had died. And so she said, you wait here. She said the next day she went, she bathed that woman, cleaned her up, and took her to her brother and said, here, marry this lady. And he did. But he was a lot older. I remember, even as a child, it was saving a life. Getting married was saving a life. This is the thing that they talked about. And she told another story of a band of gypsies. She was there through the whole genocide. It started in 1915, and she left there in 1922, left Turkey in 1922, with two small children. My father was in the United States, and my brother was born in 1907, my sister in 1909, so she had these little kids. And hiding from village to village, my brother used to tell the story, and every time he told it, he'd cry, that they were in the fields one day, and my mother went to him and said, here, take care of your sister. I'm a grown woman. They're going to come for me. I know that. And so she just left my brother and sister together, these little kids, and went and hid someplace. And for a couple of months, I mean, this was a long period of time, and then eventually came back and got her kids. I wondered, how did they survive? What did they do in the interim? What were they eating, and what were they doing, and where were they staying? You know, these are things we don't know, the logistics of exactly what happened. But anyway, this other story of the gypsies, she went out one night and this whole band of gypsies was there. And this lady said to her, whispered to her, I'm an Armenian, but I just joined these gypsies to save my life. And she said to her, "Will you wait here and I'll try to get you out?" And the next, and again, she hid the lady. And the next day, she did somehow give the lady some money or clothes or something, and she got her away from the gypsies. Years later, my mother was in a refugee camp in Aleppo, Syria, because that's what they did. She was not in the death march. Somehow she escaped that death march. I don't know how. I think from hiding.
If you're just joining us, we devote our entire show to commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide.
Another thing, when they were to leave the country in 1922, things supposedly had calmed down, but the Turkish government required them to have, I guess today we'd call this an exit visa. They had to have a stamp in their passport or their papers. And every day she'd go to the town hall and ask them to stamp her papers, and they wouldn't stamp them. Finally, she got fed up with that. She found the man that made the stamp. She had a stamp made, stamped her papers, and left with her two children. Again, it was treacherous because they were walking and they were coming down. They, too, were in that city of Kharpet. They were in one of the outlying villages, but there were Kurds in those mountains. There were Turks. They came down through Diyarbakir and Urfa and places like that. She ended up in this refugee camp. My father in the States had no idea whether she was alive or dead or what had happened to her. So at that time, he was working in Landers Ferry and Clark, and I have a letter that his foreman wrote and said, you know, this man doesn't know whether his family's living. He's going back to look for them. And so he went back and he found them in this refugee camp and got them, well, he got my mother and my sister here. By then, she also had saved a couple of nephews, and that's all she had. And therefore, I have cousins living in France. I mean, all of us have relatives all over the world, and for this reason. When I went back to her village in Turkey, a lady, because I went back there several times, a lady came out of her house and said, "I saved your mother during the genocide." And I came, she was alive, my mother, at that time, and I came and asked her, and she said, yes, she hit us one night. Now, that was at peril to their own lives, because anybody caught hiding an Armenian would also be killed.
Arthur Tverdian describes his father's visceral reaction to Turkish music in just one example of how random daily occurrences could, with little warning, trigger memories of the atrocities survivors had experienced.
The other thing that my father was very strong about was listening to Turkish music. And I can remember going to weddings, and if the band started playing Turkish music, he would get up and say, "We're leaving and going home." And we did. I can remember one time I was with, she wasn't my wife at the time, and we were at a close family friend's wedding. My parents had come with us. We had driven. And I can recall vividly my father saying, "I can't stay. Why are they playing Turkish music instead of playing Armenian music at an Armenian wedding?" And we got up and left. It was as simple as that. He couldn't handle it. So it came out in different ways, that experience. I mean, and you know, as a child, even as a young adult, quite frankly, it didn't mean anything to us. You know, what was past. We were living in the present, looking at the future. They were thinking in terms of the past and what they had experienced. As you get older, you come to better understand the past and what the past has done to create the present that you're in and how it shapes your future. And so when you look at that, I mean, I can remember my poor father. What I did to him sometimes was just unconscionable. I can remember conversations, and I remember this one vividly when we were talking about things like, you know, Turkey. And I was saying, but the Turks are the friends of the Americans. I mean, they're bottling up, you know, the Black Sea so that the Russians can't get out with the Russian submarines. He would just explode. when I would say things like that. That was just unconscionable as far as he was concerned. And so that conversation, I can remember with him, I could never quite figure out where he was coming from. Now, keep in mind, I was 16, 17, 15 years old. You know, I was into study of history, United States, and passionate about America. Didn't have a real understanding. And a lot of that, I would suggest, is really maturity, to be able to understand how people felt at these occurrences, what took place back there. And I think, you know, I marvel at the kids that I sometimes teach, that their ability to appreciate what happened and put that in the bigger context of the Holocaust and genocide in other parts of the world, to me is pretty remarkable at their maturity that I didn't have at that age. But the kids really do feel it differently. That is kind of the nutshell of the story of my father. We know that as a young adult, he had his name put on his first cousin's family list for a visa to come to the United States. He was originally done in Tabriz, and what's interesting is that when you look at the paperwork, and I've got the paperwork so I could read it, and the paperwork made it very clear that he was listed in Tabriz. He was at that point living in Kermanshah, asked to be put on the visa list there, which they would do, but it all had to be worked out. The interesting piece was, because of the limitations of immigration into the United States at that time, if he did not go, if his name was called and didn't show up when his name was called, the list apparently, and it's quoted, is approximately 14 years before your name would be called again. So you had to be sure that you were on target and knew what was going on. And my father communicated. I have copies of the letters that he wrote. It was common back then that you would handwrite a copy of a letter, correct it, write it, and then either have it typed or write it out yourself so that it would be accurate. I remember my father doing that in correspondence with other people. He would write it out and then rewrite it and send it off. So he always had the original copy to make sure that in English he said what he meant to say. At that point, he came to the United States. He was sponsored by his father's sister. So he had an aunt living in New Britain, and she sponsored him, which meant that he didn't have to go through Ellis Island. So his name doesn't appear in Ellis Island as one of the immigrants going through Ellis Island. He went directly into New York and went with some family. We're not sure who lived at that particular address, but we know that it was family, friends. He lived with them for a short time and then went to New Britain, Connecticut to work. He had written to a factory in New Britain, the Corbin Screw Company, which no longer exists. They wrote back saying that they would offer him a position if he came to work as a machinist, keeping in mind that, you know, he had a very limited formal education, although he self-taught some Russian, some French, Turkish, Syrian, as well as Armenian, some Farsi he could read. So he learned quite a bit, self-taught how to play an instrument, the mandolin, self-taught how to play rudimentary piano. So the guy was, yeah, I'm bragging, the guy was bright, obviously. He came to the United States, the only work he could get was as a machinist, unskilled laborer. He had worked for a period of time for an oil company in Iran, and he was a bookkeeper there, but probably didn't have formal skills and training in that. So that's the story of his coming to the United States.
Numerous historians and academics worldwide have recognized the genocide, including the International Association of Genocide Scholars. Documentation exists in official state records of the United States, Great Britain, France, Germany, Austria, and Hungary. The Turkish government consistently rejects charges of genocide, usually claiming that the Armenians who died there were caught up in a civil war, or that the Armenians supported enemies of the Ottoman Empire and deserved to die. A smaller group of historians, funded by the Turkish government, actively denies that what happened was a genocide. Turkish Law 301 is an article of the Turkish Penal Code that makes it a crime to insult Turkey, the Turkish ethnicity, or Turkish government institutions. It went into effect on June 1, 2005, as part of a package of law reforms preceding negotiations for Turkish membership in the European Union. in order to bring Turkey up to, quote, Union standards. The earlier version of the law made it a crime to, quote, insult Turkishness. In 2008, the wording was changed from Turkishness to the Turkish nation. Turkish historian Taner Aksam left the country fearing for his life after claiming there had been a genocide. In 2006, Armenian-Turkish journalist Hrant Dink was prosecuted under Article 301 and received a 6-month suspended sentence. In 2007, he was assassinated by radical nationalists. One of the primary ways of erasing the Armenian culture was by the so-called Turkification of orphans. Hundreds of thousands of young children were placed in Ottoman orphanages and converted to Islam, forbidden to speak Armenian, and given Turkish names that often matched the first initials of their Armenian surname and given names. By order of the Minister of the Interior, the only children permitted to stay in the orphanages were those who didn't remember what had happened to their parents. Many Armenian children were brought up in Turkish families, a subject that remains sensitive to this day. Muslim Turks who acknowledged their Armenianism were labeled by the Turks as outcasts, gabur, those without belief, without a soul. Those who were not brought up in Turkish families were killed. According to the order of Talat, the Minister of the Interior of the Ottoman Empire was instructed to remove all non-Turkish Armenians from age 5 and up, and to take them out of the town to be slaughtered. They were subjected to the worst crimes of humanity. Some were burned alive, others poisoned or drowned, starved to death, or left to perish from disease. Mass burnings of children took place in large part in the Bitlis province. A Swedish missionary named Alma Johansson ran the German orphanage in Mush and reported that many Armenian women and children were burned alive as orphans. Mass burnings also took place in Derzor, where the orphans were first taken to a large building, then pushed in batches to a spot an hour from the city, where they were doused with petrol and torched to death. Such practices also existed in the provinces of Harpert and Diyarbakir. Turkish physicians engaged in the poisoning of children. Survivors have testified how in one province the local pharmacist and doctor organized the poisoning of approximately 500 orphans. Based on evidence from local Turkish doctors, officials have testified that babies brought to the city's Red Crescent Hospital were also systematically poisoned. Those who refused to take the so-called medicine were drowned at the nearby Black Sea. There were other mass drownings. Large numbers of Armenian children were disposed of at the Mesopotamian lower ends of the Euphrates River in Derzor. There, the chief of police, on October 24, 1916, ordered approximately 2,000 orphans carried with their hands and feet bound to the banks of the Euphrates. Reports are that two by two, the children were tossed into the river, to the perceptible enjoyment of the police chief. Mass drownings of children occurred in other regions, including Kamakh Gorge on the Euphrates River. At that time, U.S. Ambassador Henry Morgenthau said that at Kamakh Gorge, hundreds of children were bayoneted by the Turks and thrown into the Euphrates. Ruth Swisher's mother was orphaned along with her two sisters and was shifted from place to place before finally arriving in the United States.
My mother, as a child of 12, was put in the orphanage because she was quite beautiful and the Turk wanted to marry her. And like I said, this is all hearsay. My mother actually did not tell me this. A lot of other people in New Britain have told me these stories. She was in Yereki in an orphanage. And from Yereki, they went to the city of Harpet. They were there for a while. Then they were going to go to Lebanon. They were going to transport the children to Lebanon. The Lebanese did not want them. They ended up on a boat going to Istanbul, and the boat had a leakage in it, and they thought the children had drowned. But actually, they survived. They had a mass after 40 days in Istanbul, you know, just a remembrance, a 40-day remembrance. And then when they arrived in Istanbul, they had a massive celebration for all the orphans. But unfortunately, the Turks started stoning these orphans, so they were unable to stay in Istanbul, and they were looking for passage or for some country to take them, and no one wanted the orphans. Finally, Venizelos in Greece said, "Bring the orphans to me. I will house them." I don't know how many orphans there were. I have no clue. but they were a mixed bag. They considered each other's brothers and sisters. As a matter of fact, to the end of my mother passed away, she was still looking for people, and they were finding each other. Every now and again, one would come across. Well, anyways, they ended up staying on Constitution Plaza in the old palace in Greece. Venezuela's put them up there. There must have been about 300 orphans. I'm not quite sure of the number. And then they went to Piraeus, and they stayed there for 3.5 years after something was built for them, some facilities. And from there, my mother went to Beirut. She lived there for 12 years and then came to America and married my father. That was a fix-up. My name is Ruth Hovsepian Swisher. My mother's name was Sidanush Simonian, but she went into the orphanage as Sidanush Barbarian because the Turks were looking for her. And she went under an alias. She just kept going back to Yeriki, where she was born, and talking about this neighbor and that neighbor and this mulberry tree or this apricot tree or some such thing, but never of the atrocities that happened to them. Absolutely nothing. She would tell my daughters more than she would tell me, and then they always spoke of it in the house. Other villagers would come over, and they would talk about the different things and the orphanages, etc., and that's how I pieced things together. And what I have is actually factual, because my mother did tell me that they were stoned, and the boat was sinking, and there were other people in New Britain, a Yelsal Mazadorian that was on the same boat, and, you know. All I know is when I was growing up, I was a very slow eater. My mother said I would never survive in the orphanage.
As you will hear, when asked if they can forgive the Turks for the crimes of 1915 and the continued refusal to acknowledge the genocide, first-generation survivors' feelings are as varied as their individual experiences. For many, it is difficult to forgive as long as the descendants of the Ottoman Turks continue to deny that their predecessors engaged in genocide.
And of course, my father was a Gamavor, and a Gamavor means a volunteer. He joined the French army, and they signed papers that they were only going to fight for the sake of the Armenians. And he went from village to village to village, to all the orphanages, looking for people. He didn't find a soul. His family was all gone, just completely wiped out. Oh, yes, he went to one orphanage, and on the door was their orphans' names. And he found a first cousin, and she ended up coming to New Britain to live. My father's family is very sparse, whereas my mother had more. I think more survived in her family than my dad's. There were only 5 living relatives on my dad's side. And they weren't even brothers or sisters. They were just first cousins, actually. From large families to dwindle down to nothing.
During the genocide, the Allied powers, Great Britain, France, and Russia, responded to news reports by issuing a warning to Turkey. Quote, "The Allied governments announce publicly that they will hold all members of the Ottoman government, as well as such of their agents are as implicated, personally responsible for such matters." Such warning had no effect, however. After World War I, the young Turks in power resigned their government posts and fled to Germany, where they had been offered asylum. Turkey's new moderate government and the Allies asked repeatedly that Germany return the young Turks to stand trial at home. These requests were denied. Armenian activists located the young Turks and assassinated them, along with 2 other instigators of the mass murders. A new Republic of Armenia was formed. Representatives attended the Paris Peace Conference with hope that the victorious allies would return their historic lands seized by Turkey. In response, the European allies asked the United States to assume guardianship of the new republic, something that President Woodrow Wilson wanted, but that Congress rejected. Thanks to Wilson's persistence, the Treaty of Sèvres was signed on August 10, 1920, recognizing an independent Armenian state in an area comprising much of the former historic homeland. But Turkish nationalism persisted. The moderate Turkish leaders who had signed the treaty were ousted in favor of a new national leader, Mustafa Kemal, who disavowed the treaty and reoccupied the lands in question. Surviving Armenians were expelled, including thousands of orphans. No allied power would come to the aid of the Armenian Republic, and it collapsed. Just a small portion of the easternmost area of historic Armenia survived as part of the Soviet Union. Some ask what the importance is of formally recognizing the Armenian genocide. One need only look at history for an answer. A young Adolf Hitler remarked on the tepid reaction of the world's power elites to the plight of the Armenians. After he achieved power in Germany, in 1939, Hitler decided to conquer Poland, telling his generals, quote, "Thus, for the time being, I have sent to the east only my death's head units, with the orders to kill without pity or mercy all men, women, and children of Polish race or language. Only in such a way will we win the vital space that we need. Who still talks nowadays about the Armenians?" In 2008, a group of Turkish intellectuals offered their apologies to the Armenian people in an online petition, available in 8 languages. The petition read, quote, "My conscience does not accept the insensitivity showed to and the denial of the great catastrophe that the Ottoman Armenians were subjected to in 1915. I reject this injustice, and for my share, I empathize with the feelings and pain of my Armenian brothers and sisters. I apologize to them." In the first 2 hours after launching the petition, over 5,000 people signed, including over 200 Turkish journalists, historians, scholars, musicians, and political scientists. Turkish media reported a sharp criticism of the initiative by the country's nationalist circles. A group of nearly 60 former ambassadors reportedly issued a joint statement warning that the started campaign was, quote, "fraught with negative consequences for national interests." While citizens of Turkey and Turks living in different countries around the world signed the petition, they nonetheless avoided using the word genocide, instead calling the events the Great Catastrophe.
This was done by design, by government design. That's what they're trying to deny, that it wasn't a design, but it was, because it was done so systematically. First the intelligentsia, then the villages and all the men, then leaving men, women and children. This and it was step by step by step.
They took doctors or the men, like you say, the intelligentsia, and that was the end. My mother-in-law told me that story. I remember very well. Then she had a brother, Zadeh, whom my husband was named after because he was a boy. They took him and they kidnapped him, and they don't. What happened to him?
A Turk wanted to marry my mother at the age of 12. And as a matter of fact, he came to this country. He went to Beirut to find my mother's relatives after the massacres, looking for my mother. And they hid my mother in Beirut. And then he came to America, and he sent his brother to America looking for my mother when he found out my mother had come to America. That's the truth. He went all the way to Worcester, and they wouldn't. He found someone in Worcester from the same village. Yeah.
And when I had my first child, she was 1 year old. We were in Florida on a vacation, and she got feverish. And there was a doctor there. They said on the premises, and he's Turkish. He'll treat your daughter. I was frightened to take medicine from this medical man. You know, this is 1958, 59, and I was still afraid of what a Turk might do. But just to bring us up to 2010, my husband right now, at present, this is Roxy speaking again, has almost like a best friend, Turkish grocer in our neighborhood, who we speak very openly of the genocide to him. He never learned any of these things himself. And he marches in Washington with the Turks, which I'm still against that. But he loves us Armenians, he says.
I just want to mention that the women have a different exchange. ruled than the males in the family. As young males, we were heavily protected from this this event.
On April 12, 2015, Pope Francis, the leader of 1 billion Roman Catholics around the globe, referred to the slaughter of the Armenians as the first genocide of the 20th century. His words angered Turkish diplomats, who condemned them and recalled their ambassador to the Holy See. Previously, officials at the Vatican have avoided using the term genocide. But the Pope said, quote, "It seems that the human family has refused to learn from its mistakes caused by the law of terror, so that today, too, there are those who attempt to eliminate others with the help of a few, and with the complicit silence of others who simply stand by." Around the world, April 24th marks the observance of the Armenian Genocide. On that day in 1915, the Interior Minister of the Ottoman Empire ordered the arrest and hangings of Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople. It was the beginning of a systematic and well-documented plan to eliminate the Armenians, who were Christian and who had been under Ottoman rule and treated as second-class citizens since the 15th century. The unspeakable and gruesome nature of the killings, beheadings of groups of babies, dismemberments, mass burnings, mass drownings, use of toxic gas, lethal injections of morphine, or injections with the blood of typhoid fever patients, render oral histories especially difficult for survivors of the victims. Why did this happen? Despite being deemed inferior to Turkish Muslims, the Armenian community had attained a prestigious position in the Ottoman Empire, and the central authorities there grew apprehensive of their power and their longing for a homeland. The concerted plan of deportation and extermination was effected in large part because World War I demanded the involvement and concern of potential allied countries. As the writer Grigoris Balakian wrote, The war provided the Turkish government, quote, their sole opportunity, one unprecedented, to exploit the chaos of war in order to carry out their extermination plan. As they escaped to several countries, including the United States, a number of Armenians came to New Britain, Connecticut in 1892 to work in the factories of what was then known as the hardware capital of the world. By 1940, nearly 3,000 Armenians lived there in a tight-knit community. As you will hear from the stories of first-generation Armenian survivors,
there is going to have to be a really massive uprising in this country against the entire system, because every time we're trying to tinker around the sides, the fact that we don't have a healthcare system in this country is something that is so horrific that I just keep thinking at some point there needs to be a real uprising against this system. When will it happen? I don't know. And so in the meantime, I think, yes, we have to fight for those crumbs, but what we want is the whole pie.
That's Medea Benjamin, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Medea Benjamin on system change. The multiple problems facing the United States can no longer be swept under the rug. Modest so-called reforms are not sufficient given the magnitude of the crises we face, from imperialism and militarism to war and the climate emergency. Our dollar-driven politics is corrupt. We need system change, not cosmetic change. Individually, we can do small things, but connecting with kindred spirits and organizations can make a difference in not only overcoming isolation, but can lead to changes in consciousness and positive initiatives. One such organization is Code Pink. Founded in 2002, it is a women-led grassroots nonprofit working to end U.S. wars, support peace and human rights, and redirect our tax dollars into healthcare, education, green jobs, and other life-affirming programs. Medea Benjamin, a co-founder of Code Pink, is our guest today. She's a renowned peace activist and social justice advocate. Newsday calls her one of America's most committed and most effective fighters for human rights. Author of many books, her latest is War in Ukraine. I talked with her in the studios of KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, in early April. Welcome to the program, Medea.
Great to be with you, David.
Henry Luce, the media mogul, founder of Time, Life, and Fortune, declared in an influential essay in 1941 that the American century was at hand. Well, it looks like that prediction might be coming up short by a couple of decades. Beset with multiple problems, from a shredded safety net to trains literally going off the rails to grotesque inequality, to the threat of more pandemics, to the existential dangers of climate chaos and terminal war, where does the U.S. stand today with its worldwide archipelago of military bases and a war budget of $1 trillion? And with rising gun violence at home, the inability of the state to protect its own citizens, lots of guns abroad, lots of guns at home, is there any connection between the two?
It is important to recognize that we have created this country that puts so much of our funds into militarism. It's now almost $1 trillion of our budget. It's more than half of the discretionary funds. It's more money than the federal government puts into things like healthcare and education and housing. And so, of course, we have a system that is reflective of that. You know, you have to look at the budget as a moral document. And there we see what Martin Luther King would have called approaching spiritual death, because we put so much more of our funds into destruction than programs of social uplift. And I think when we talk about the violence abroad and the violence overseas, we have to see that connection, because There are so many ways to make those connections. One is to say that when you glorify violence overseas and you glorify the military and you teach people to go overseas and carry weapons and use those weapons, what do you expect when those people come home? Every time there's a mass shooting in this country, I always wonder, was that somebody in the military? And the majority of cases, it was.